Welcome to Community Conversations, a monthly program on KUMD dedicated to fostering community connections. With this November marking the 75th anniversary of Kristallnacht and November 20th, the anniversary of the beginning of the Nuremberg trials, this month Community Conversations brings Holocaust educators to the table to talk about commemoration and personal journeys of Holocaust education. This program also airs during the commemorative Jewish holiday of Hanukkah, the Festival of Lights. My hope is that our guests this evening inspire you to learn more about the Holocaust, this history of genocide, and how it impacts us today, and to engage community to help you on your journey. Tonight we hear from film producer Sandra Scholberg, who spent the last 10 years restoring her father's documentary film, Nuremberg, Its Lesson for Today, recorded live in the Nuremberg trial courtroom and banned in the U.S., but recently restored and released. Also from the UMD Bummler Kaplan Foundation, Cindy Christian and Deborah Peterson-Perlman. They share their experiences traveling to Germany, Poland, and the Czech Republic, and also talk about local learning opportunities. Welcome to the program. Let's start with introductions.
Deborah Peterson-Perlman, I'm an associate professor of communication, but I'm also the chair of the Bummler Kaplan Holocaust Commemoration Committee, something I've done for about 15 years.
I'm Cindy Christian, director of the Allworth Institute for International Studies, and I am a member of the Bummler Kaplan Holocaust Commemoration Committee.
Bummler Kaplan was established about 20 years ago, actually, after the death of Walter Bummler. As it happened, Walter's death brought in quite a few donations, and the family was very interested in setting up some kind of memorial for him. And Walter had always done Holocaust education in his own classes, and the family was very committed to continuing that project. Plus, the family was very well acquainted with a broad swath of the Duluth Superior community, and in particular were friends with Walter and Goldie Eldott from the Jewish community. Walter Eldott had been a newspaperman in Duluth for many, many years, and he himself had lost family members in the Holocaust. So Walter and Goldie were very interested in Holocaust education. In addition, there was another pot of money that had been put aside for Mortrude Kaplan, who was a local pharmacist. And the executor of his estate was a man named Bob Caron. Bob Caron was an attorney who was well-beloved, particularly in the Jewish community, and was aware that Kaplan's sister, Ida Grubnik, was interested in putting that money to work and decided that Holocaust education was a good venue for that money. So Uncle Bob and the Bummler family decided to join the funds, and they started an endowment in the amount of about $25,000 to host an annual commemoration. And so it had been going on for 5 years before I joined, and they'd had some pretty big names, not least of which was Gerda Weissman-Klein, who'd written a book, All But My Life, and about whom a film had been made by the same title, and that film had won an Academy Award. So bringing her to the UMD campus was a major, major coup, and it got a lot of attention at that point, and the committee just really started to grow and develop.
And the Allworth Institute has been a part of the Bummler Kaplan commemoration from the beginning, initially supporting it more financially. But as that endowment grew more in terms of just the work of the Allworth Institute and supporting the speakers that Bummler Kaplan brings in. And then we've built into our program, every year we try to have a presentation in our Brown Bag series, which is at noon on Thursdays, that reflects the theme of the Holocaust or experiences that people have, you know, going to camps or focusing on a specific issue. We also very often try to have our Allworth Book Club read a book in connection with the Holocaust commemoration in the spring.
Yeah, I'd say we're really partners, and I've certainly looked at Allworth as a partner, but more particularly, Cindy has been a really important member of the committee. I mean, she's somebody on whom I rely quite heavily for all kinds of things, but she's been really, really active in suggesting ideas for things that we could do. For example, she brought us the book, The Book Thief, And we use that as part of our commemoration when Leonora Baumler did her presentation back in 2008. That was her 80th birthday. And she did a wonderful presentation called Zeitzeuge, which means time witness, and talked about growing up in Nuremberg, which, of course, had been a bit of a Nazi capital in some respects. And then we decided to pull together this presentation on the book thief. We did a reader's theater promoting the book, and Cindy's the one who brought us the book. I mean, she'd read
it. It's a great book.
It's a great book, and now, of course, it's a major motion picture in the theaters.
Due out November 27th.
The organization has brought so many people to campus and the community. Do you have a favorite from past years?
We both have our favorites. I think my favorites might be a little bit different from Cindy's. But, for example, David Gewurztman and Eugenie Mukeshimana, that was a really wonderful intersection of somebody who had been through Auschwitz, had survived, and then somebody who had been through the Rwandan genocide and survived. And so their conversation was amazing. And I'd say that was a real highlight in our history. But we've had a lot of really good programs. We also brought Marion Blumenthal-Lizanne, who wrote a memoir of her childhood called Four Perfect Pebbles, about her mother, her father, and brother, and herself having gone through the Holocaust and survived. We had an artist named Samuel Bach who brought his own artwork, and we had three other artists featured in an exhibition at the Tweed, which was, the exhibit was great. We had Fred Friedman's son, Alan, come and produce his oratorio called With Perfect Faith. I'd say that was a real highlight as well. It was a wonderful performance and brought in the UMD choir. Stan Wold conducted his choir, and we had Amy Bernstein, who was the rabbi at the time, performed. So we've done a lot of amazing things, and we've had some really great programs.
Yeah, I think that the ones Deborah mentioned are my favorite, too. The Holocaust Rwandan thing was very powerful. I mean, there were people in the audience that were crying. I mean, grown men that I know aren't always, you know, that emotional, as it was so powerful and brought the two realities together, you know, what some people see in the past and then things like that, similar genocides still happen. Marion Blumenthal-Lizanne, I got to take her around to a couple of schools, middle schools in Superior, and that was just such a treat to see her interact with the children of that age. And she, I mean, it really affected them, and it was, she handled it so well with such class, and to tell her story in a way that would touch them but not, like, scare them. So she was wonderful.
Yeah.
Right.
I think Sabina Zimmering was another favorite. She was an ophthalmologist at the University of Minnesota for many years and wrote a memoir called Hiding in the Open, and talked about coming with her sister to Nazi Germany as a guest worker. And she and her sister ended up at this hotel in southern Germany where the Nazis frequented, and they were both maids, and they managed to survive the war hiding in the open. Later on, a play was produced on the same story at the Minnesota Historical Theater, and she's a very unassuming person. She's teeny tiny. She's maybe 4'8", 4'10". And I didn't know if she was going to be a really dynamic speaker, and she ended up being incredibly powerful. And she's small, and she's got a small voice, but her story was just so amazing. And she, too, like Marion Blumenthal-Lizanne, extended herself to the community.
Lots of the events are held at UMD, but the community is invited, right?
I think one of the things that we're trying to do is go out into the community a little bit more. That hasn't always been possible, but the Lawyers Without Rights exhibit was a great opportunity for us to partner with the Federal District Court in doing programming surrounding this exhibit that was at the federal courthouse this last week. And it was a really great opportunity to make connections and to address different issues that we probably wouldn't have come up with on our own. I mean, Lawyers Without Rights is not something that would have been top of the mind awareness for us, but learning about the situation. And of course, we knew about the Nuremberg laws and other acts of, as Cindy has put it, cultural annihilation that have taken place over time. But this particular exhibit made it very personal because the panels in the exhibit told individual stories. And some of those stories were stories of resilience and perseverance. And some of those stories were stories of murder and brokenness. So it was great to have that opportunity. Unfortunately, you know, we did a couple of programs that did not draw a lot of people. The exhibit itself was a tremendous success. But we had a presentation on Kristallnacht. It was the 75th anniversary of that pogrom and a really important milestone to commemorate. And we had a small turnout at that. I mean, it was a respectable turnout, but it was small. And it's one of those stories that I think really needs to be told. You know, I was disappointed that we didn't have more. And then we showed the film Judgment at Nuremberg, and Fred Friedman, the public defender of Duluth, who's now retiring, and Tad Johnson, who's the chair of the American Indian Studies Program here at UMD, co-facilitated a discussion about the film that was great. They did such a wonderful job, and we had just a handful of people there. So we hope to reprise this coming up. You talked about not just having these events once a year. You know, we've done things in the fall as well as in the spring, but I'm thinking we probably will have much more activity coming up this spring semester. So hopefully we'll be able to reprise the film, and we're also going to be doing some reading groups on children's literature, the Holocaust, a short course on Anne Frank, and then we're bringing the renowned children's author, Jane Yolen, who wrote The Devil's Arithmetic, among other books, other novels on the Holocaust. And she will be our featured speaker in April.
And one of the things I think the programs outside the campus is that a lot of survivors are passing away. And while that used to draw a lot of people, there's so many more issues and perspectives that we can look at the Holocaust from. A historical perspective, looking at children's literature, looking at events that can give you a wider understanding, so to add to those personal stories. So I think while having a survivor speak is important and it's a draw, there's still a lot we can do outside of that.
I also interviewed Sandra Schulberg, whose father made the film Nuremberg, It's Lessons for Today, and it was named that just 2 years after the trial because he thought people might be forgetting after just 2 years. It was unreleased or banned and is really in its first release. This is all inside the courtroom footage recorded live from the trials. I think that people do think that they know.
Yes.
And I think it's important, too. I mean, you can get so bogged down in how things still happen. There are still crimes against humanity, and it can lead to a sense of hopelessness, too. And that's hard to deal with. It's hard to deal with. And I study human rights violations. You know, we have speakers that talk about torture or things happening in Syria and other parts of the world. And sometimes I go home at night and I'm like, I don't want to do this anymore. I don't want to think about it. I don't want to, you know, I mean, it doesn't last very long because it's important, but it's difficult to know. So how do you do that? And that's why it's so important to keep talking about it.
Right, right. I think, you know, there are a lot of people who don't want to deal with it. I mean, people who are very close to me don't necessarily want to address it because it is so difficult. It's so hard. And it's hard to rise above the despair. And I think that's what we're talking about here. And that's why traveling with a partner was so worthwhile this past winter, and why it was that much more difficult on my own. I wouldn't have traded the experience to be on my own. It was a different kind of situation. This summer I'm going back and I'll be in Eastern Europe, and I won't be with my friend. I'll be with a group, but it'll be people I don't know. So, you know, that'll be yet a third experience. I had been to Dachau as a child with my family, and so I guess that will be a fourth experience, really. Each one different. The context makes a difference, I think, in the way that you're able to receive it and process it.
Well, and Deborah also just in October traveled back to Amsterdam, Germany. And our purpose last December and January was to visit some concentration camps. So we wanted to go to Terezin in the Czech Republic, which was the camp the Nazis used to show the Red Cross that the Jews weren't being mistreated. It was supposedly their model camp. And we went to Auschwitz, which was really in Poland, which was important for both of us, and then to Ravensbrück, which we were interested in because it was the woman's camp. So, I mean, it was a very powerful experience. And then we went to the Jewish quarter in Prague to get a sense of the history of, you know, anti-Semitism didn't exist. The Nazis didn't create it. And the camps weren't the only instance of that hatred being manifest. So it was a very powerful experience. And, you know, I think we both had different personal reasons for wanting to go there. But definitely a life-changing trip. I think everyone should go to Auschwitz. I wish everyone could, because you certainly come away with more of a sense of the reality of it. Mm-hmm.
And then this past October, I went on my own to Buchenwald and Bergen-Belsen. And it was a very different kind of experience from having traveled with Cindy. I mean, the two of us could sort of rely on each other to debrief and decompress and process what we had experienced during the day. Doing it on my own was a very different kind of situation. I think particularly after spending 5 hours at Buchenwald, I felt at the end of my time there so heavy. I felt the weight of the history pressing down on me physically. And of course, emotionally, I was overwhelmed. It was an incredibly useful thing for me to do, a very important thing for me to do. But you have to take it in doses. It was intense. The other aspect of being at Bergen-Belsen was the fact that there's a base not too far off, and they were doing munitions trials. So I'm walking through the camp, and there's this explosion, and it rattled, I think, it rattled me. I have to believe it rattled the other people who were walking through the camp as well. But I think the lesson from our experience was I got to have room to breathe, and it really is helpful to have another person. And, it, you know, traveling with my friend made a big difference for me.
And I think part of it, too, was having that space to also, in the areas where we stayed, you know, Prague and Krakow, to get a sense of the history of those places, and, you know, and how the Holocaust fit into it. And that was helpful, too.
The three camps in Germany, Ravensbrück, Bergen-Belsen, and Buchenwald, had the distinction of being in physically beautiful spots. So you go through the woods, and there you are, in the case of Ravensbrück, right on the lake. It's very picturesque. In Buchenwald, you know, you travel on a road that was built by the inmates. Again, there's this beautiful wooded area. It's lovely. And then you're confronted with the horror of what happened there. And yet, again, I think so critically important that people actually step onto the property and, in the case of Bergen-Belsen, look at these numerous burial mounds. Here lie 1,000, here lie 5,000, here lie 800. There are so many of these throughout the camp. The physical structure isn't there any longer, but there are ghosts. You said something earlier that really resonated with me, and that's the idea that people think they know. The thing is, you can't know. You can know a little bit, but there's no way to fully comprehend it looking backward. I think the best we can do is to continue to study and process and think and talk, and doing it in community is really critically important. And so our programs, I think, are so meaningful in that regard. And I want people to understand that going to a program or reading a book is not sufficient. It's not enough. You really need to be in community to move further along on that road.
Still today, there is new documentary information never seen before, like the footage and film from the trials at Nuremberg. The father of film producer Sandra Scholberg was in the U.S. military and created many films for use at the trial, as well as a documentary about the trial.
My name is Sandra Scholberg. Nuremberg, Its Lesson for Today is actually a movie that my father made that was then lost for fascinating reasons, political reasons, and which I ultimately decided was my duty to restore.
How did this film come to be?
The decision was made to hold a trial, to prosecute the top Nazi leaders. It was decided that they would attempt to use not just documentary evidence, but in the sense of paper documents, but also to use film evidence, that which was the first time in history that was ever done. And this particular unit, the John Ford unit, in which both my uncle Bud Schulberg and my father Stuart Schulberg served, was assigned the task of finding the Nazi films that could be shown in the courtroom as evidence. So their first task was to scour Germany in the summer of 1945, just within a few weeks, really, of the end of the war in Germany, to look for this film evidence and also photographs that could be used as evidence in the courtroom. As my uncle Bud described, they came across, in some cases, instances of sabotage. They found thousands and thousands of cans of film still burning when they arrived. But eventually they were able to put together a four-hour film for the courtroom called The Nazi Plan. And they also put together a one-hour film for the courtroom that they called simply Nazi Concentration Camps. So these two films were the films that my father's unit compiled and were screened on a big movie screen in the courtroom. One of the other fascinating things about this whole story is that this courtroom in the Nuremberg Palace of Justice was reconfigured specially to show film. And it was also configured to permit the filming of the trial itself. That was another first. Such a proceeding had never been filmed before. You know, today we take cameras in the courtroom for granted, but this was a revolutionary idea. Once the trial was over, the War Department asked my father to come back and to make the film about the trial. So Nuremberg, Its Lesson for Today, consists of footage that was shot in the courtroom. So you see the prosecutors and the defendants, and you hear them for the first time speaking for themselves. And then when it cuts away from the courtroom, you're seeing generally excerpts from either the Nazi plan or Nazi concentration camps. And these excerpts are used in the film about the trial very much in the way they were used at the trial. In other words, to substantiate the four counts of the indictment.
Some people may not know exactly what happened at the Nuremberg trials.
At Nuremberg, as you see in the movie, five high-ranking German military officers were prosecuted. As a result of that first trial, the Americans decided to hold 12 more trials in the same Nuremberg courtroom, which, by the way, is a working courtroom today. You know, people really, even if they know something about World War II, and I think World War II is part of everyone's education, but you know, we have to remember back then television had been invented, but people didn't have televisions. Almost no one knows anything about the Nuremberg trial. And I think part of the reason is that this film was suppressed. Nurembergfilm.org is the website. There's a tremendous amount of information about, you know, about the team that originally made the film, about the OSS film unit that prepared the films for the courtroom, and a lot of information about the finished film, as well as information for people who'd like to show the film. The film had a huge impact in Guatemala and Argentina when we showed it, because there were trials going on in Argentina for crimes against humanity while the film was playing there.
You just toured this film in Russia. Talk about the reception of this film.
Yes, it was a marvelous experience. The State Department and our U.S. Embassy in Moscow you know, asked me to bring the film there and sent me to four different cities. We screened the film at universities and at various NGOs in St. Petersburg, Moscow, Yekaterinburg, and Vladivostok. Everywhere I went, I found that the film had a profound impact on people. It is, I have to say, it's a little embarrassing as an American to bring a film about World War II and the Nuremberg trial to the Russians, because they suffered more losses than all the other countries combined. And, you know, I think unlike in this country, these memories are very close to the surface and are still extremely painful. And in every audience, I met people who had lost family members. You know, it was like one in four people in a family was killed during the war. The film really struck home in many ways, and partly because, you know, people said, for instance, why did we never prosecute the crimes of Stalin or the crimes that were committed in the gulags. Why is it that this film is not more widely shown? It reminds us of the importance of human rights at all times and especially today. So the film provoked a great deal of discussion. I showed the film in Tehran in Persian at the first ever international conference on humanitarian law, where people were just open-mouthed. They hear a lot about the fact that the Holocaust maybe has been grossly exaggerated or that maybe it didn't happen at all. This percolates down even in the intellectual class to lawyers and judges and law students. So they were really amazed by the film. The only way that you would have seen anything of what was going on in that courtroom, let alone the story of the whole trial from beginning to end, which you see in my father's film, would have been by seeing such a film in a movie theater. This film in 1948, 1949, with the rise of McCarthyism and the fear of the so-called communist menace, became politically incorrect. And the fact that it was not shown, that it was buried for so many years, I think is part of the reason that people still know so little about the Nuremberg trial.
Sandra Scholberg was in Duluth for the Lawyers Without Rights event in November and talked with many about the film. Deborah Peterson-Perlman.
Well, I'm hoping that we can bring Sandra Scholberg's film back to UMD. I spoke with her at the reception, and I'm very hopeful that we'll be able to bring that film to Duluth. It sounds amazing, and I'm really excited to have the opportunity. She seemed very positive. And, you know, it's one of those things where this is documentary evidence that you can't ignore.
And another thing about seeing those, you have that. And then, you know, when you think about a sense of hopelessness, you connect Nuremberg to, for example, the tribunals about the former Yugoslavia. I mean, those are going on. And we have, you know, if Nuremberg hadn't happened, if they hadn't done that, we wouldn't have these and we wouldn't have a war crimes tribunal, Rwanda. So that connection is there too. And I think it's important for people to make those connections. And you can't do it unless you take the time to watch and learn and talk and listen to the experts. Mm-hmm.
More information about Nuremberg, its lesson for today, can be found at nurembergfilm.org and local events through the Baumler Kaplan Foundation at d.umn.edu and at allworth.org. Thank you to our guests this evening, Deborah Peterson-Perlman from UMD and the Baumler Kaplan Foundation, Cindy Christian from UMD's Allworth Institute for International Studies, and Sandra Scholberg, an American filmmaker and producer. Community Conversations is produced at KUMD by Lisa Johnson, Maya Jensen, and Chris Harwood, with funding provided by the Minnesota Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund. Thanks for listening.